Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Hazen Jihu. It's my pleasure to introduce Raj Patel, author of A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Raj is an award-winning writer, activist, and academic. He is a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and a senior research associate at the Unit of Humanities at Rhodes University. He has worked for the World Bank, the WTO, and the United Nations, and has had the distinction of being tear-gassed on four continents, protesting his former employers. Raj has organized protests around the globe in support of food sovereignty, social justice, and testified about the causes of global food crisis to the U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Committee. For his efforts, he was recognized with the James Beard Foundation Leadership Award in 2016. Raj can be heard regularly on the Secret Ingredient podcast and is currently working on a documentary food about the global food system. He is the author of several books, including The Value of Nothing, which was the New York Times international bestseller. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Raj Patel.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Hazen, and thank you all for coming out on a very smoggy night. I want to dive right in here. Jason W. Moore and I wanted to present a history of capitalism. We make the argument that capitalism was born out of a climate crisis, a crisis of disease, and an uprising in feudal Europe. And if we're right, capitalism is coming to a similar kind of crisis, a crisis structured around seven cheap things. Let me just give it away for you. Those cheap things are nature, work, money, care, food, energy, and lives. Now, what we're suggesting is that as capitalism reaches a crisis, that can end well or badly. And the moment that we're in at the moment is one that shows both of these possibilities. And rather than sort of ramble on about the medieval warm period and the crisis of feudalism, I want to make this sort of more up to date. So can I just see from a quick show of hands, if you've heard of the Anthropocene? Many of you have, some of you haven't, and if you haven't, the idea of the Anthropocene is this: that if there is a civilization that comes after ours, they will be able to trace the record of Homo sapiens in the fossil record because we will have left things like radioactivity from atmospheric nuclear tests, and we will have left plastic in the oceans. By 2050, there will be more plastic in the sea than fish. But there'll also be another signature that Homo sapiens was here, and that signature is chicken bones. Chicken bones. From this bird, Gallus domesticus, the world's most popular bird. Right now, there are 12 billion of them alive, but not for long. In the course of a year, humans go through about 50 billion of these, so we can fully expect trillions of these bones to be laid down in the fossil record. Why are we waiting? You know, why so many birds? Well, because we're eating so many of them. But the fact that we're eating so many of them isn't a natural phenomenon at all. If you look here at a graph of U.S. Chicken consumption, really the spike, the climbing of chicken consumption happens after the Second World War, when the chicken producers move U.S. tastes away from chicken just for eggs, to chicken as food in itself. And so being pushed by the chicken industry, I suppose you'd call them Big Bird, from 1945 onwards, you see a very steady rise in the number of pounds of chicken per person that we eat. So now it's over 90 pounds per person per year in America. And that's a global phenomenon. You see the increasing rates as a planetary phenomenon. The planet is now consuming about as much as U.S. U.S. individuals did in the 1960s, and that number is rising. And that's, you know, per person per year. So why? How does this happen? Well, initially, of course, this is a story of cheap nature. The original chicken, the red jungle fowl, was taken from the jungles of Southeast Asia and South Asia. And its genetics were plundered, and the people who had lived alongside this bird were treated as fairly disposable. They were treated as natural as the bird, and anything that's in nature is fair game for turning into money. And this bird has been bred to the state where now modern chickens are so that their breasts are so large that they can barely walk. But for the chicken species that aren't commercially useful, face a no less ignominious an end, though perhaps less profitable. 50% of chicken species now are extinct. Let me just click my way through this, if I can make it do that. Oh. Well, we'll need to move forward, yeah. This idea of cheap nature is, the fact that we can treat birds as disposable, as entire species as disposable, is symptomatic of a broader phenomenon, which some have called the Great Acceleration, where our socioeconomic trends are accelerating just as our destruction of the environment around us is accelerating. Now, for those of you listening at home, what I'm showing now is a series of graphs of bad things. We can see that. Essentially, if you're at home and you imagine a red line that's fairly close to the bottom axis and then accelerates as you move towards the present day, it's a graph of bad things, is what I need you to imagine. But how is it that this happens? First of all, of course, that externalization of nature is an important part of our story here. But the birds themselves don't turn themselves into chicken nuggets. They require workers, and right now we have a system that depends on cheap labor, cheap work, in order to turn these animals into nuggets. And if you look at the workers in the chicken industry, you see that they are exposed to five times higher rates of occupational illness, seven times higher rates of carpal tunnel syndrome, and 10 times higher rates of repetitive strain injury from micro tasks. And right now, the chicken industry is applying for waivers from our Secretary of Agriculture so that they can increase the rate at which these birds pass through a line and pass inspections to numbers approaching 200 birds per minute. And that's, these workers involved in the business of chicken are treated incredibly badly. For every dollar that we spend on chicken in a fast food restaurant, only 3 cents will reach workers. And sometimes not even that. Some workers like these are prison laborers. In the US, we have a well-developed system where people who are incarcerated will work for, in this case, 25 cents an hour as part of the work scheme to be able to make our food cheap in this country. And of course, the trouble is that this army of cheap workers isn't happy. And we are seeing rebellions, we are seeing strikes, and we are seeing workers striking back. And we even see it in the world's industrial heartland in China. We're seeing an increase in the number of strikes. So we're not just seeing a crisis in terms of nature, we're seeing an emerging crisis in terms of work. Workers are becoming more expensive. But that's why we're also able to see the rise of another institution, one that's never really gone away, the rise of slavery. Today, according to the International Labor Organization, there are 40 million slaves, 25 million people in forced labor, 15 million in forced marriages. And if you look at the kinds of occupations that they're in, we have 11.3% of them are involved in agriculture and fishing. But also, the largest part of today's slavery is involved in care work, in domestic work. Now, why? What has that got to do with our chicken? Well, actually, look at the kinds of injuries that are involved in the chicken industry. There is no part of the body that is untouched by the kind of violence that chicken manufacturing inflicts on workers. Who looks after them? Who looks after these workers after they are spat out? There have to be communities where care is administered, and that work often disproportionately falls to women. And we can demonstrate that by looking at the gross world product in 1995 was $33 trillion. $16 trillion of that was unpaid work. So if you think about it, the unpaid work that happens in the world around us is a sizable proportion of the number that gets our president and our business leaders are very keen to crow about. But it depends on an invisible amount of unpaid work and care work, of which in 95, 11 trillion was women's unpaid work. But in order for this work to happen, in order to be able to care for people, you do need food to be cheap. And of course, the emblem of that is the dollar burger. But a dollar burger is not just an American phenomenon. If you think about the way that food has been made cheap internationally, you can see, again, for those of you who are listening at home, what I'm showing now is a graph that shows that fresh fruits and vegetables have, since 1990, risen in real terms everywhere, from China to Brazil to the UK to Korea to Mexico. But a number of processed foods have become incredibly cheap. And chicken, of course, has increased very little in most places. And in Mexico, of course, the price of chicken has tumbled because of NAFTA. Now that, as we record this, the president is opining that the U.S. may withdraw from NAFTA, that will return the tariffs that U.S. chicken producers face back to 75%, which means the fact that chicken is cheap in Mexico is just because the U.S. has been dumping cheap chicken in Mexico. But you need cheap food if your wages are low and you're depending on an unpaid army of people to take care of broken bodies. Cheap food is a sine qua non of the world food system. And unfortunately, because of climate change, that's running out. So if you look at projections, global projections for wheat and for maize, we're seeing that during this decade, yields are projected to drop by 4% for maize and 5% globally for wheat. So cheap food isn't going to be an option in the future. And this is not even to think about sort of the effects of superweeds or the secular declines in productivity that we're seeing in a range of countries around the world and a range of crops. One of the ways you can substitute for that, of course, is piling on fertilizer, which requires cheap energy. And just to return to the chicken story, I mean, to have a room full, barns full of chicken requires cheap propane. And of course, that again encourages and depends and results in carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels. And of course, the irony here is that we've become used to cheap oil, and the price per barrel, the capital expenditure per barrel of oil has been going up. And what we've been seeing is that a study came out a couple of weeks back observing that most of the oil extraction activities in the United States wouldn't have been possible without loans from the government. So while we're hearing a lot about fracking, the fact is that when it comes to oil in this country, you need cheap money. You need loans from the government in order to be able to make this activity profitable. And you know, certainly when it comes to fast food, cheap money is an obvious bonus. The Small Business Administration makes available loans for franchises like Kentucky Fried Chicken, for example, because franchises are small businesses in the eyes of the U.S. government, and you can apply for a loan up to $2 million in order to have taxpayers concessionally underwrite your enterprise here. The trouble is, again, this cheap money is running out, and so are the sources of profit for it. We're seeing secular declines in the world rate of profit, and there's only so much cheap money that can sort that out. By cheap money, I mean money that is with interest rates at practically zero. And if you think about the federal interest rate, really since the end of the Second World War, save a spike in the 1980s for inflation, we're now at a period where interest rates are practically zero. You can't get lower than that. And the era of cheap money, in order to be able to prop up this financial, to be able to prop up this exploitation of nature and these profits, is also running out. Perhaps the most difficult thing to remember here is the idea of cheap lives. You know, we began with this idea of cheap nature, that nature was there for us to plunder. Nature, the idea of cheap nature has a corollary. And it's the idea that when Columbus found the United States, when he found the Americas, when he found the New World, he had a very sort of clear idea of what he was seeing. What he was seeing was nature, all of it, the people and the plants and the animal. All of them were fodder for him and for his profit. He wrote to Ferdinand and Isabella that he was very sad that he saw these amazing plants and animals, and what brought him ultimate sadness was that he did not know how much they were worth. But what Columbus did know was how much the humans were worth. He grew up in Genoa, in Italy, where 5% of the population were slaves. And he understood that slavery was an incredibly profitable thing. And in fact, after his second voyage, Columbus wrote again to the monarchy in Spain, "Let us, for the love of the Holy Trinity, capture all the slaves that can be sold." And the idea that there would be a certain kind of supremacy, that there would be one self-constituted race lording it over others, is something that still matters today, particularly in the food system. If you think about who's working in the chicken industry, they are disproportionately people of color. I was talking to a union organizer at the Teamsters the other day and asking, does race and the possibility of discrimination on the basis of race, does that matter at all? This old white guy was saying, look, it would be impossible to overstate how pernicious racism is on the chicken line. And the idea that actually the very process of capitalism ejects certain people from civilized society and includes others, that's an important and often unstated part of the history of capitalism. I could show you a picture of the Ku Klux Klan to remind you about the United States' rather unsavory past in this regard. But actually, race matters for the food system. In order to be able to have the wide open plains, in order to be able to have the kind of food system in which Chicago can be the hub of food exchange, you needed to exterminate indigenous people. This is the scalp of Taoye Taduta, a leader in the 1862 Sioux uprising. There was a bounty on him for $500, and he was only returned to his family in 1971 after being on display in the capital. The idea of clearing off people who were natural, who were savage, who were outside society, who were closer to nature, that's the corollary of having this idea of cheap nature. And cheap nature, of course, if I can show you this, I mean, this is a picture of the bison skulls that were, again, the bison were essentially rendered extinct. And their skulls were piled high, again, funded and encouraged by the U.S. government, though these particular skulls were then ground up and sent off as fertilizer to be used on the Great Plains to be able to feed the food system on which we now depend. Though, of course, now these are extinct. I mention all that because if one's thinking of the sort of reductio of what the modern food system is like, then it looks like this. Again, for those of you at home, this is a picture of then-candidate Trump eating Kentucky Fried Chicken on his plane using a knife and fork. It's one abominable orange thing next to another. I think it also sort of signals a way of understanding what's natural about the way that we think right now, and it's also an augury. Everything that has gone into the chicken that we were talking about earlier on is sort of on display here in one way or another. The cheap money, the cheap energy, the cheap work, the cheap lives, all of it is here. But it doesn't have to be this way. The trouble is that if we're moving to a different kind of world, it's not clear to me that the private sector is an ally here, particularly when one's thinking about transformations in the food business. So I was sent to a report called Expect the Unexpected, Building Business Value in a Changing World. It's a 2012 report by those bomb-throwing anarchists at KPMG. Now, KPMG did an analysis, and they looked at every major industry, and they said, well, all right, what's the earnings before interest tax, depreciation and amortization? What's a big revenue number? And then they said, all right, well, what's the damage that these businesses are causing the environment, expressed as a percentage of revenue? And they said, well, in some businesses, like oil and gas, $670 billion of revenue, and only 23% of that is damage, external damage. Now, that seems to be a very low number, but let's assume that they're correct. The trouble is that, for example, in the sort of Uber industry here, and by Uber industry, I don't mean Uber, I mean food, $89 billion of revenue, but the food industry has an external footprint of 224% of revenue. What this means is that there's no sustainable business model for the food industry. And you don't have to take my word for it. You don't even have to believe KPMG. I was sent to this by one of the vice presidents of sustainability at Nestlé, who said, yes, these numbers concur with the ones that they have at Nestlé. So what does that mean? That means that no matter how good a label you find on your food, the crisis that the food industry is really the canary in the coal mine here, but all of these other industries are part of the same kind of complex. There's no way out of it in the terms set by these industries, and we need another way out. But here's where the despair begins, because most people these days are able to imagine the end of the world, but very few of us are able to imagine the end of capitalism. We can imagine the end of the world fine. We can imagine the Anthropocene. We can imagine all of these extinctions. But the good and the bad news is it's not the Anthropocene. It's the Capitalocene. There's nothing about humans that are necessarily driving the world to extinction. There are many human civilizations that have done a not bad job of not exterminating the planet. There are lots of indigenous peoples who have figured out ways of managing natural resources, sequestering carbon, and increasing their welfare without planetary destruction. So it's not about being human that's the problem. It's about the system of modern capitalism that results in the externalization of these costs and depends on these seven cheap things which are running out. So what do we do? Where are the spaces of hope? Well, let me wind up by showing you a few of them. When one thinks of combating the idea of cheap lives, of course, one might think of Black Lives Matter. But Native Lives Matter is important, and in fact, it's been going on much longer. When we think of the various kinds of energy revolutions that people are fighting for and winning. When one thinks of the end of cheap nature, what I'm showing here is a picture of Haida and coastal Salish totems. And the reason I wanted to show them is because, we're in the valley here, you're a foodie crowd. This is a foodie story, and a really interesting one. In coastal Salish traditions, there's this idea of the Salmon Festival. Has anyone heard of the Salmon Festival? Those of you who haven't. So the idea of a salmon festival is this. The first salmon comes, and the Haida people will capture the salmon. And for the next 10 days, you celebrate the salmon and the return of the salmon. Now, while this is happening, for 10 days, the rest of the salmon are spawning. And you're not allowed to fish them. For 10 days, you're only celebrating the one. And the rest of the time, you're allowing this natural system to regenerate and provide new salmon for the next year. After the 10 days, after you've celebrated your treaty with the salmon people, because that's what this is. This is a treaty obligation. Then you're allowed to go fishing reasonably. But for 10 days, you have to respect a treaty. Now, that's a very different relationship from, is it the season to catch or not to catch? A treaty is about two peer sovereign nations negotiating with each other. Now, you may say, the salmon don't have much say in that. But actually, the idea is here that in some deep way, the salmon kind of do. Because don't respect the treaty and the salmon won't come back. And that idea of treating nature very differently, not as a resource to be extracted, but as something in which we recognize that we are not above but our peers, is a very different way of thinking about nature. And one can make similar story. One can tell similar stories about work, and the rise of cooperative working arrangements. One could talk about the rise of new forms of care and unionized care that's happening around the country and around the world. And one could also talk about reparations, about recognizing that we have, the fact that we are able to live the life that we do is premised on the fact that we've spewed so much carbon in the air. Now, that may not feel like a privilege right now with Napa on fire, but the fact is that the only reason we're in this room is because we have been supported and propelled here by a fossil fuel economy. Now, we didn't ask for that. We were born into it. But, in the same way that, for example, I have to take ownership of sexism and patriarchy. I've been brought up in a society that's patriarchal. I've been brought up in Western society. And in this patriarchal society, I have to own that. I didn't ask to be brought up in a patriarchal society, but nonetheless, it's wrong. And I have to stop that. I have to do everything I can so that my kids are not brought up in the same kind of patriarchy. That's the right thing to do, right? No one wants me to be more sexist. Everyone recognizes that we have to end that. But just in the same way that none of us asked to be brought up with the dividends of fossil fuel economy, we have to take a relationship to it. And we have to own that. And we have to own that it's not okay for us to proceed in the way that we do without recognizing what it is that we have taken. And that means reparations. And I think that we need to, that's a serious discussion that we need to have. We need to actually make the giving of our bounty not just the sort of thing that happens when we, the sort of thing that happens, sorry, let me just move forward here, as a sort of charity on a church food bank, but the kind of thing that can happen as, for example, the Black Panthers once did. When they were giving away food, it was to recognize that there's a crisis of survival among the poor in the United States, particularly among people of color, but also to move towards a world a world of transformation. That this, the Black Panthers food program, is a program about survival pending revolution. And with capitalism teetering on the edge, there are a lot of ways that we could go. I mean, the idea of white supremacy and of fascism, like we see in India, for example, is one direction that one might head. But it's not the only one. And it seems to me that we have right now before us many inspirational examples of how it is that we might transform this world away. And what we need is much more of an exercise of an imagination and much more organizing to move us away from a rather dark future. But maybe that's a point at which I should leave, and we can start the conversation. Thank you.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It's sort of interesting that Christopher Columbus plays a fairly major theme in your book. I know the book's just coming out, and so maybe I'm one of the few people who've had a chance to dog-ear it and go through it. But more curiously, how did you celebrate Columbus Day?
by not celebrating. Jason and I spent Columbus Day talking about the new Columbuses. Mm-hmm. And you know, in some parts of the world, Columbus Day is celebrated and fated as a man brings civilization to the Americas. In other parts of the world, including in Austin, Columbus Day has been renamed Indigenous Peoples Day for the perhaps more accurate description of man brings death to Indigenous people in the Americas. But either way, that makes it seem like it's done and dusted, that it's in the past. And it's not. I mean, look, here's Columbus, and here's what he does. He persuades a bunch of financiers that what is going to happen, he's going to find new frontiers, new ways and new spaces to be able to bring incredible riches back to his financiers. Now, he hasn't a tremendously good track record of turning a profit, but he has a very silver tongue. And he's able to make financiers part with a large amount of cash in order to be able to get him to new frontiers. And on the way, he exploits his workers. You know, he had a prize for the first person to spot land. And the first person who spotted land was one of his sailors. And Columbus said, no, yeah, you may think that you spotted land, he said the next morning after the sailor had said, no, I found it. But in fact, I was awake then, and I spotted it. You just rang the bell first, but I was going to. And he basically stole the prize from his worker. When one thinks about, you know, well, who is it today who's offering new frontiers, who's treating their workers perhaps not so well, who's managed to raise huge amounts of money to get to these new frontiers without really turning much of a profit, and you're thinking about Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, right? These are people who are off into space. And Jeff Bezos has, in fact, explicitly said on a NASA web interview with for junior space cadets that the reason he wants to go to space is to propel entrepreneurship forward onto the moon, which is a very Colombian thing to say. So I know this is awkward because you work at Amazon.
He's my boss.
But nonetheless, it does need to be said that actually a lot of these ideas around Columbus aren't over. Columbus started them, but we're coming to the next iteration. That's why we're seeing these crises, why people are going into space in order to be able to make money and to colonize. And Elon Musk says it very explicitly that the colonization is part of the mission here. That's why Columbus Day was a day not of remembrance, or not just of remembrance, but of worry for the future as well.
Because it was interesting through the book, he was kind of the segue into every one of the cheap things. And as I was going through the book, I kept thinking, well, who is the modern day person that's like this? The concept is not dead, of course. But it was also interesting that when you sum up the seven cheap things, I was thinking, well, is that a long list or a short list? What did you call? How did you come up with this list, first of all? And what would you? Did you want to put more things on it, but didn't fit on the book title, or how did you come down to the seven things?
Obviously, there'll be a sequel. it seems to me that while one might think of things like housing, for example, as other cheap things, in the Bay Area, no one would confess that housing is cheap. For us, we see these as really the originary parts of what was required to get capitalism off the ground. One could adduce other kinds of strategies that have been employed by capitalism to be able to render things cheap and not count the full costs. But in general, these seven seem to be at the heart of the project, that's really how we got to them.
Because if we talk to a little bit, and I just want to go through sort of each one of them a little bit more deeply here, and think about it in slightly more modern terms of how maybe we break the bubble, or how do we start the inflection point to change. And some of them are changing, some of them seem to be fairly stuck. But if you look at something like nature, for example, and there's sort of an absence of value when somebody looks at something. You look at a forest, and someone says, oh, lumber, make houses. They turn it like capitalism, turn it into a product, and sell it. Where other people look at it and go, that's a carbon sink. So it actually has value as a standing forest. And if you look at like the Amazon, which is being somewhat decimated by illegal logging, they pay indigenous people to say, protect the forest, because it has value like that. So why do you think there's an absence of that kind of value vision in the modern age. People look at things as just commodities. How do we break that?
Well, I worry that to turn the Amazon into, from being one kind of source of value as rare tropical timber into another kind of value, which is potential carbon sink, is still to miss literally the forest for the trees. The idea here is, and I think this is a phenomenon of the sorts of civilization that we find ourselves in, where nature is the sort of thing that you go to a state park to see. And our relationship to nature is what it is that we do when we put our Birkenstocks on and go for a stroll, or we bike through it or whatever it is. But that when we're in an auditorium like this, we're away from nature. That we are somehow not still natural beings breathing air that is connected to the world outside. And that idea that we suspend our relationship to a web of life, except for when it is that we're, we're out rambling somewhere, is precisely, I think, the problem here, that we've managed to attenuate our connection to other living beings to the extent that, we only interact with them when they are our pets, or when we buy them, or when we cook them, or when we ramble in it. So that seems to me a very profound cultural shift. It's not the sort of thing that one can remedy merely by putting price tags on things. I think there was a story in the New York Times very recently about miners in the Amazon bragging that they had killed indigenous people because the indigenous people inconveniently were on some precious prospecting areas. These ideas of indigenous people and their way of interacting with nature, we don't have to romanticize them. But we have to recognize that there are certainly other ways that are different than we are capable of sensing right now. I think that it does require a very profound shift, and I think one of the ways that we can encourage ourselves to do that is by not thinking about nature in terms of money at all, but by understanding our relationship to to the web of life in some fairly different ways. And there are world religions and world cultures that encourage us to do that, but they're not unfortunately to be found in the heart of capitalism.
So what do you think about industries that have sort of, in my opinion, have popped out of nowhere for no reason? The bottled water industry doesn't make any sense to me. And you mentioned more plastic than fish by, 2030 or 2050.
2050 was the World Economic Forum projection, yeah.
2050, there's more plastic than there is fish. I don't eat plastic, so I'm not sure what we'll do there.
By 2050, you won't be eating fish either. The last commercial catch is in 2048.
2048, that's disastrous.
Just FYI.
So what kind of movements are to looking at new industries that are popping up? And I use the water bottle as an example, that it was unnecessary, although it's better that people are drinking more water. But the sort of external costs associated with it, half of the water in Fiji goes to Fiji Water, and they have a poverty problem there. So what movements are happening in nature that you look at and you say, that's a really good one to support because it's going to be a high impact to change philosophy?
Well, I mean, I like the kinds of movements that are joined up. So the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, has ideas, has an archipelago of schools that practice something called agroecology, which is about sort of this interaction with nature that recognizes that rather than farming the old way, where you essentially nuke the soil and then you replace the ecosystemic services that you've just destroyed by fertilizer and pesticides and herbicides, you develop a rich and robust ecosystem. And those kinds of approaches to nature, where you recognize that actually you need to nurture ecosystems rather than destroy and replace, seem to me to be incredibly powerful. And they're popular among farmers in the global south, not because people are going around, again, sort of proselytizing with beads and Birkenstocks, but because farmers in the global south have seen climate change. And they know that the monocultures are not robust against the kinds of extreme weather events that we've seen recently. There were a series of natural experiments with Hurricane Mitch in the Caribbean, where farms that adopted this kind of agroecology were back on their feet after 90 days, after 3 months. But farms that didn't have this kind of agroecology were only back on their feet after 180 days, after 6 months. And that's a loss of an entire season, more or less. So those kinds of movements where people are saying, look, this is about food, but it's about culture, but it's also about nature, but it's also about reducing our fossil fuel footprint, but it's also about women's empowerment, because La Via Campesina has taken women's empowerment very seriously makes gender violence an integral part of its agroecological training. All of a sudden, that joined up thinking is much more powerful, it seems to me, than the sort of thing one might just sign up for with the Sierra Club. And I like that idea of joined up thinking because this is a joined up crisis.
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely global. Let's move to money. You had an interesting quote in the book that said, Wall Street organizes nature, which I took to be you commoditize nature, it goes onto the market, and people just start trading it all over the place. And subsequently, if you look in America, there's hardly any manufacturing that goes on anymore compared to the roaring, manufacturing days. Mm. We're just sort of moving commodities around. And people are driving it with the other quote I liked in there was, modern day colonialism is financial power. If you have financial power over people, place, or things, then it's basically owning the space and you get to suck the profits out. So we have a lot of these global organizations I think you protested against this, the World Bank, WTO, the IMF. Mm. How is their behavior going to have to change in order to use money or capitalism or the funds that they have for funding projects to move away from some of these seven cheap things that they've created or contributed to?
I don't think that, I think that what the World Bank needs to be doing is atoning. This is the sort of institution that in order to encourage people to value healthcare, prevented people from poor people from accessing healthcare unless they could pay for it. Now, of course, we struggle with that in the United States. But when there were robust healthcare systems in countries where they were available to everyone, the World Bank introduced fee-for-service arrangements in order to be able to encourage a more market-oriented approach. Those kinds of actions have consequences, it seems to me that the World Bank is not the sort of institution that can fix the problems that it created. Right? The quote that's falsely attributed to Einstein is that the kind of thinking that got us into this mess is not the kind of thinking that's going to get us out of it. I don't think that the World Bank has anything to do other than to pay reparations for the damage that it has caused from the kinds of projects that it has funded internationally that have encouraged the extraction of fossil fuels, that have displaced indigenous people, that have caused, in fact, increased gender inequality through the kind of farming commercialization that they're fond of. I do think that we do need different kinds of mindsets than the ones that prevail at these organizations. But we don't. These organizations are not the ones really to lead us to the light.
Do they need to be dismantled? Then?
Well, yeah, I do think that they need to be dismantled, and of course that's why they won't be. I mean, they have long been instruments of U.S. foreign policy, right? The IMF and the World Bank explicitly are instruments of U.S. foreign policy, and it doesn't seem to me that anyone is in any particular hurry, except perhaps the U.S. budget director, who today was taking aim at the IMF with some pot shots about how they don't want the tax plan to succeed in America. Plan being a very loose use of that word. But the idea here is I think these are not development agencies, they are foreign, they are foreign policy agencies for the United States. I don't see that changing.
So to flip it to cheap work, as I try to get through all these things in time here. So there are some interesting practices that are happening here in the Silicon Valley. I don't know if it's to cheapen work, they're always presented as incentives, because you want to work here because you get these other things. But they have these interesting byproducts that make the work feel cheap, because you're getting more productivity because you're putting in more time. And they're things like, I'm not naming any companies in particular, but free food. Mm. So I never have to leave campus. I always have lunch. I can go there early for breakfast. I can stay there late for dinner. I have food coming in at 10 o'clock at night. I can be there all day. Unlimited PTO. Anytime I want to take time off, my manager says, just organize it with me, and it's just fine. And all of these things, and there's other examples of these so-called perks. You know, I can jump on a shuttle, and I get free Wi-Fi at 6 a.m., and I can start work at 6 a.m. and take my shuttle home at 10 o'clock at night, and I have free Wi-Fi, so I can work all the way home. And all of these things, it tends to, my day becomes very long. I'm salaried. These aren't personal examples, by the way. But people are, and employees are looking at this and saying, these aren't benefits. These are just a way to really make me work hard. So how do you get away from the trickery of, oh, we're going to give you all these kinds of benefits, when in fact they are demeaning the employees?
Well, I mean, I think that it's interesting that some of the ones you mentioned are about cheap care, cheap food, you know, the ability to have the work of you having your dry cleaning done and having your food cooked for you is a way of providing that cheap care and making that work seem, you know, and also encouraging a certain kind of loyalty to an organization that may or may not have your best interests at heart. But I also think that it exists simultaneously with a range of other things, right? That we're seeing, for the coders, of course, you get the sort of Cadillac class exploitation. But the exploitation of other people is not quite so glamorous, right? I mean, we're still seeing janitors being treated incredibly badly in Silicon Valley, despite the vast amounts of money that are being made here. We're also seeing, again, you know, we were talking about slavery earlier on. The coltan in our consumer electronics often will come from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and people are involved in slavery-like conditions there. To be able to provide this rare earth metal that's present in all our consumer electronics. In other words, you have simultaneously, you know, high-end exploitation, low-end exploitation, and slavery bundled together in Silicon Valley. And again, that's Columbus 101. You know, I mean, that's how he rolled too. Now, this isn't to say that you know, that Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are participating in are slavers, but you know, whenever you press a button or say, "Hey Alexa, you know, buy me toilet paper," you are asking. Alexa is only able to get that stuff for you because of the slavery that allowed the coltan to be in this device in the first place. So this is to say, look, you've got multiple ways in which labor is exploited, and all of them layering one on top of another. You might think, "Oh no, slavery is a thing of the past. Now we just have badly treated workers." No, you have all of them layered like a cake. And that's been going on through the beginning of capitalism.
So how do you think things like the robotic employee will change the value of work? When you bring in high levels of automation and robotics and AI, what's that going to do to cheapen work?
Well, I mean, again, when you're looking in the United States, you have this massive push towards the service industry. You know, the largest industry in the United States, the big growth industry here, is of course the food industry, where people are being paid bottom dollar. Had I more time, I would have run through a slide from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that shows the worst median wages in America that range from sort of $9 some an hour all the way to $10.20, $10.30. And if you look at the rankings, almost all of these jobs are in the food industry. These are service jobs. You know, if it's not in the food industry, it's in grooming, and it's in a range of other services where robots are not, although there's some push towards automation in the food industry, the fact is that actually where automation's been tried, yet more labor is required. You just don't see it. You make your order on an iPad, and the food magically appears, but who do you think is doing that in the back? There's a lot of sweat, and particularly a lot of sweat of working class people that's making that possible. So I think automation is a way of masking the shift towards the de-skilling, not just of workers in at the front end of the house, but when you see robotics in farming, you see the de-skilling of farmers as well. I worry about that a great deal, and I do think that it's a way of just forcing wages down for a working class that's already suffering. 50 million Americans food insecure, and that number's set to go up. The poverty rates are set to go up in America because of this kind of technological intervention.
So we've talked a little bit about food, because there is a robot that can make you a hamburger now.
I've seen that, yes.
I'm not sure I trust it. But anyway, are you a vegetarian?
Trust the hamburger. Sorry?
Are you a vegetarian?
I am, yes.
Oh, okay. So, and fellow vegetarian in the crowd.
Go and, veg. Just go big green or whatever it is. Yeah.
And as a vegetarian, are you still hopeful that we can turn around and save the world? By the way, I'm not, which means that they're not a vegetarian, or they're not,
hopeful
we turn around the world. I'm not sure.
I get this question a lot because, look, when you look at these trends, and particularly when you look at the graph of bad things getting very bad, how can you not be depressed? How can you not understand that actually that we're already moving towards state shift in the way that the planet operates, right? The majority of ecosystems are moving towards a state shift that's going to be irreversible. Let's just accept that. That in and of itself might make you incredibly depressed. But when you look also at the movements that are fighting back, and you look at the creativity in many of these movements, with the same clarity that you're seeing the state shifts happen, you have to honor the bad news, but you also have to honor the good news. And you have to look at these movements for change and look at the kinds of systems really systemic responses that are coming, particularly from communities in the global south. I do a lot of work with a group called the Soils, Food and Healthy Communities Project in northern Malawi. And the work that they do is both about, it's about addressing food insecurity, about women's empowerment, about climate change, about a range of things. And they've managed to end child malnutrition in their part of northern Malawi. And that kind of thinking and that kind of approach seems to me marvelous. Western experts couldn't do it, but here we are, a bunch of farmers in sub-Saharan Africa who managed to end food insecurity and child malnutrition and end gender inequality in their villages. That kind of thinking, that kind of approach, it's disrespectful to be pessimistic when you see that. One doesn't honor that work, and one doesn't honor the work of the 200 million farmers in La Villa Campesina who are fighting, again, on similar lines for similar kinds of victories. So, yes, we are moving towards a state shift, and there's nothing, even if we transform the way that we operate tomorrow, that's going to happen. But the question is, all right, well, what do we do with that? And when you recognize some of these other changes that are happening, one can embrace a slightly more optimistic future. Now, I'm not being Panglossian here. I can also see white supremacy on the rise. I can see fascism in India on the rise, right? I'm not at all rose-tinted about the future. But nonetheless, I have to respect the millions of people who are doing incredible work. And when I see I'm honored by the work that they're doing, honored to be just on the fringes of what they're doing, I feel that it's wrong to be entirely pessimistic.
So how do you influence change? And let's pick a behemoth in the energy sector right now, the oil barons or large oil corporations, highly profitable. You can certainly point to many examples of devastation in other countries due to fossil fuel extraction. But there was a value came out that said, if we wanted to be off fossil fuels worldwide by 2050, it'd be about a $45 trillion investment to try to make that leap. How do you go after something like Exxon, who makes $32 billion a quarter? How do you say, hey, the future has got, it takes some investment, but the payback is huge? How do you even start that conversation with people who are so capitalistically driven and so profitable that how do you get your message across?
Well, I mean, I think one can't do it in the terms that make sense to shareholders. But luckily, everyone I met at these organizations is, by day oil executive, by night human being, and people who are connected to others and who are taking a relationship, you know, who are concerned about the future of the planet. And it's weird that we find ourselves in a time where, you know, oil executives are slightly more concerned about the future of the planet than the U.S. government is, or the head of the EPA. Nonetheless, I mean, that's not saying much. But it's I do think that there are ways that are about direct action. That are not about addressing and writing polite letters to Exxon saying, "Dear Exxon, we'd very much like it if you would shift to something a little less destructive of the planet. Lots of love, humans." I think we need to be following the kinds of example that we saw with the Dakota pipeline. I do think that this is, frankly, a life or death issue. And I mean, we already see that in the United States, hundreds of thousands of people are projected to be losing their lives as a result of climate change. Globally, of course, that figure is much, much higher. We have a responsibility to put our bodies on the line and to stop these projects happening, to make them costly for Exxon in every way imaginable, because our lives depend on it. And it doesn't seem to me that there's an easy answer. There's no writing to the head of the EPA because the head of the EPA is on the side of these industries. This is a time for direct action, and it's a time for making these kinds of actions unacceptable. I mean, just in the right now we're recording, and Harvey Weinstein's in the papers for alleged egregious sexism and sexual assault. The fact is that his defense is what used to be acceptable once, and now he recognizes the error of his ways because it's not acceptable anymore. We need to recognize that while it may have been acceptable for oil majors to get away with destroying the planet, it's really not okay. And that kind of cultural and visceral kind of popular uprising against these kinds of horrors. We've seen it because of the struggle of the women's movement to be able to make people like Harvey Weinstein a pariah. But it seems to me that we need to be doing the same with the horrors that are inflicted by these oil barons.
So a lot of things are driven, of course, by capitalism and your capitalist scene scenario. So do you think it's the end of capitalism or just sort of the end of you want to make capitalism more unregulated, make it freer, if that's possible? Or are you looking at another method? How do we get capitalism out of the system?
I mean, I think we're definitely moving towards more authoritarianism. I mean, think of the country that is waging a war on Islam. That sees Islamic terror around every corner, that's ready to embrace coal and lie about its commitments to climate change, and is driven by an egotist, a narcissist, a liar, who has one of the largest social media presences. And that country is India. Narendra Modi, the largest Facebook presence. He's an avowed Islamophobe. He really doesn't give a hoot about climate change. And the cult of personality that he's been able to assemble around him has been observed by many commentators to be, sort of textbook fascism. Now, that's the country that one might look to for as a kind of augury, as a kind of way of re-regulating our relationships to be able to manage the decline of capitalism. So it seems to me that India is a country to be looking to and to be very scared about, because that way we could go too.
So, do you think population growth is a major issue for these cheap things? Or do you think we should maybe have population controls to help surround ourselves with mitigation?
The graphs that I was showing earlier on showed that these sort of hockey stick of how bad everything is getting. But remember that it's getting bad because some people are consuming quite a lot and are destroying the world quite a lot. If we all consumed as much as Bangladeshis, we'd need basically about a third to half of the planet. So if we're interested in population control for the sake of the planet, then the thing to do is to exterminate Americans. Now, when I hear people talking about population control, that's not usually the way they want that story to end. But ultimately, this isn't just about population control so much as consumption control, and that's much harder to talk about. It's much easier to say, well, look, if only these brown people would stop shagging, everything would be better. But I certainly agree that if we want populations to stabilize, we need to embrace things like women's empowerment, women's education, girls' education, men's education for gender equality. But also then we need to be raising incomes, because it's no good being educated if there's no way that you can be assured that your family is going to survive. And so the rapid redistribution of wealth from rich to poor is a great way for reducing large family sizes down to smaller family sizes. It's also a great way of encouraging women's education and encouraging human rights. And so I think that if we're interested in population stabilization, that's a great thing. But if it happens not through violating people's human rights and forced sterilization, as has happened in India, but through the embrace of genuine democratic engagement of women's empowerment and of redistribution, I think that that's a great way to go. And it could be, that would be terrific. But only then if we move also to a world where we're consuming very differently to the way we're consuming now.
So do you hold up, you have some fears about India in the future. Do you look to another?
India now.
No. Do you have a nation in the world that you could hold up as the aspiring agent of change and say we should be doing more of that?
Yeah, I mean, I like the Haida nation. I like the Muckleshoot nation. These are nations that are within the United States. Of course, we're a country of over 500 nations. I think the Muckleshoot tribe is doing incredible work. There are nations right here in the United States that are really very, really inspirational. We don't have to go halfway around the world to find them. And I think that because they're not the same thing as a state, but they are a nation, and they are a community that has found new ways of organizing and being together. I think that that's something to take great inspiration from.
So we're down to the last few minutes of the program, unfortunately. I only got through a couple pages of my notes, but there's a common theme of the questions here, of course, a lot of it having to do with what kind of personal activities and everything you can do. But an interesting one here, outside of revolution, which often leads to violence, how do we move past capitalism? What do we want to do to spur innovation and progress? I sort of had as my last question here a similar idea, and so I'm just going to put down here about personal things that people can do to try to break some of these bubbles. Mm-hmm. And you can nod your head and say, that's a great idea, which is the preferred answer. Or you
that's
can...
That's a great idea. That's
or just give me your own thought on it. So when I look at nature, I'd say, well, for personally, I should lower my carbon footprint. That should be a focus of my lifestyle.
Go on.
That a great idea? Okay. I look at money, personal debt. That's almost keeping live simpler. I don't have to have every gadget, although I have Alexa. But anyway,
you can have a conversation with her about personal responsibility this evening. But here's the thing: I worry that if we just approach this as a personal lifestyle choice, we're taking the big agency of change off the table. And maybe this is the right note to end on. That, look, we could say that we individually are going to change our relationship to nature by hugging a tree, or that we're going to consume less, we're going to reduce our carbon footprint. All of these are good ideas, but big systemic change never happens through these kinds of individual transformation. Pick your favorite transformation in the world, civil rights movement, women's rights, whatever it is. It never happened because individuals pledged to do the right thing. It happened because we organized and that we allowed ourselves to dream bigger. And this exercise of moving, imagining what happens after capitalism isn't the sort of thing that you can do alone. It's not a sort of, you and your therapist imagine a world after capitalism. It's only the sort of thing that we can imagine and engage with collectively. And that's the great peril right now, is that if we imagine this individually, we find ourselves in small lifestyle boxes, and we just go to Whole Foods and we buy our way into the better world that will never come. But unfortunately, the right have this down, where they're organizing collectively. Their ideas of white supremacy are not individually spread, but they're collectively spread. But I do think that collectively, when one thinks about these movements for change, everything from the Movement for Black Lives to 350.org to Via Campesina, these are large organizations that are inviting us in and inviting us to be part of them. And I think that it's only through that collective engagement The idea that we should strip away our individuality, our idea of consumer choice, but instead embrace this bigger idea of social transformation. The invitations are out there, and all we have to do is accept them.
And just finally, how important do you think it is to vote?
Well, I mean, I think that when you're choosing between Coke and Pepsi, the choice is not a very interesting one. Much more interesting and much more democratic is changing the terms changing the choices for which we vote, and that requires the kind of big organizing that we don't get by just clicking or choosing X on a ballot box. Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed this evening program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We'd like to thank Raj Patel, author of History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet, our audience here in Palo Alto, and for those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you so much. Excellent.